Today on Political Rewind, state Democrats plan to leverage the Atlanta presidential debate to expand their voter base in Georgia. A surprise possible candidate for president could shake up the contest. And President Trump comes to town and works to woo black voters. Political Rewind starts now. Glad to have all of you with us for Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Let's get right to our panel because we have so much we want to talk about. We start with AJC's lead political writer, Jim Galloway. You read Galloway in the Wednesday and Sunday paper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. Jim, we're going to talk about it maybe, but just we always like to have a preview of your Sunday column, which has been posted online. Just what's the basic theme?
Basic theme is that Brian Kemp has thrown down a gauntlet on health care in Georgia, and Kentucky did the same thing for Democrats on Tuesday.
Yeah, they did, and we may get a chance, I hope, later in the show to talk about that. I'm really thrilled also welcome to the show, State Senator Nikema Williams, who is also the chair of the Georgia chairwoman of the Georgia Democratic Party. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Big day for you today.
It's a big day in Georgia.
Yeah, we're lucky to have you here, and we have a lot we want to talk with you about as we get through our conversation. Patricia Murphy is back with us. Patricia, of course, has a lot of experience up on Capitol Hill working for a couple of Georgia senators, among other work on the Hill. But she is now a columnist for Roll Call, a syndicated columnist. You can read her on Roll Call, but also in papers across the country. And Patricia, what I always love, you're writing for Garden and Gun, one of the truly cool magazines.
Thank you. Thank you. I consider it my day job and my fun job.
Yeah. Okay. We are about to be joined by Republican strategist Leo Smith. Ironically, Leo Smith, a Republican, has been caught in traffic caused by President Trump. Apparently, roads are shut down all across North Atlanta. So as soon as Leo gets him here, we'll bring him into the conversation. But, Senator, let me start with you. We haven't had a chance to talk to you since the decision was made that the Democrats would hold their debate on November 20th here in Atlanta. How do you imagine, the most basic question, that you will be able to leverage that to the advantage of Georgia Democrats?
So I think, number one, just the significance of having a presidential debate in Georgia. We haven't had a debate here since 1992. Yeah. And ironically, that's the last time that Georgia went blue for a presidential campaign.
The Clinton year.
So if that's telling and a little foreshadowing for what November 2020 holds, just stay tuned. But we are using this as an opportunity to just showcase the Democratic Party of Georgia, showcase our activism on the ground, the issues that we're uplifting on an everyday basis. What we saw in 2018 in November after the Stacey Abrams election did not go away. That energy is still there. People are still turning out. We didn't stop organizing. We didn't take 2019 as an off year. We were investing in municipal races. We're all in the Savannah mayoral race, in the Valdosta mayoral race, Albany. We are making sure that we are turning out Democratic voters all across the state and not waiting for November 2020. So this debate kind of just signifies what we've been saying, that we're the battleground state and we represent both the future and the present of this country.
So there was a lot of talk after the announcement was made that Atlanta would be the location. There was a lot of talk about where in Atlanta should the debate take place. And many people were arguing that it ought to be up in the 6th or 7th district to help further the possibility the 6th and 7th would move firmly into the blue column. I know there was a lot of back and forth on this. You ended up deciding you were going to be down in the heart of the Democratic voter base, Tyler Perry's studios. Was there questioning, are we right that there was some maneuvering over that?
So there are a lot of conversations around multiple locations. We didn't get the location confirmed until much later.
Yeah, we should point out it was not the Georgia Democratic Party. Yeah, go ahead.
But it was the location was up in the air for some time because there's a lot of logistics that go into this. And so there are a number of conversations. And I'm thrilled that it's being hosted in Atlanta in my state Senate district. Yeah. And we're going to be on the MARTA line, so it's accessible. accessible to people. You can show up even if you don't have a ticket to the debate. We're going to have, like, all of the campaigns are going to have rallies outside, and you'll be able to feel the energy and be a part of this. And it's closer to the airport for people that are coming in and leaving right away. So it's a prime location. So I wish that everybody in the suburbs would get some rail, and maybe we can have some different conversations as we bring more opportunities to the state.
Jim, Nakima was laughing about one of her colleagues making, well before either the Washington Post or MSNBC wanted to say the location, Stacey Abrams.
No.
Tweeted it out.
She tweeted it out after we told her.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, go ahead.
She retweeted what she said.
We posted that, I think, maybe about 10 days before the official announcement.
Yes.
Yeah, and we talked about it here as well.
It was late on a Friday night, I remember, because I was shopping in the clearance section at Ross. And I was like, what's this?
Patricia.
That's a scoop is what it is.
Patricia, first of all, does the actual location, once you're saying we're going to commit to being in basically Atlanta, does it matter?
Okay, no.
Okay.
It really, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter. It matters that it's in Georgia. For Georgia Democrats, that is a huge coup. It really is. And it also signals to the rest of the Democratic Party at large, Georgia is a state like Texas, like Ohio, where these other debates have been held. It's a battleground state. It's an important state. And Georgia has literally not been on that list legitimately in 20 years. And so I think it's important. Nobody from outside of Georgia knows a hill of beans about Sandy Springs versus Tyler Perry. They just don't know.
Right.
I think this also is a chance to showcase Georgia as a film location and to showcase Tyler Perry's investment in the state. So I think
a lot of intentionality.
It's a good story to tell.
And I think the cultural statement is very important. Well, one of the first things is after we broke this news here that it was going to be in Mr. Perry's studio, there was a tweet that came over from the Cobb County Republican account and said, oh, Democrats are going Hollywood, which completely misses the boat because Tyler Perry isn't Hollywood.
He's the anti-Hollywood.
Tyler Perry is the anti-Hollywood.
He built his own studio.
He is the anti-Hollywood who is kind of creating this African-American entertainment media complex just south of the main part of the city.
Yeah. It does strike me, Patricia, that if you were coming in as one of the journalists from Washington, wherever, and you were going to do a piece ahead of the debate or any number of pieces, one of them would be about the enormous success of Tyler Perry and things like his 12 sound stages, each one named after an African-American entertainer, something that has not happened at any other studio in the
country. We're going to do an Oprah
Winfrey
sound stage.
Okay. Oh, this is important.
I mean, that's just a lot cooler. No offense. I mean, national reporters will get a huge kick out of it. There is also a replica of the Oval Office at Tyler Perry Studios. I don't know if that's has any plans for the evening. But no, it's a great location. And the relevance really is for the state, not for the municipalities. Although I know, of course, you know, the 7th and 6th districts would have appreciated it. There also were a lot of things going on. I'm pretty sure the Jonas Brothers are performing in Gwinnett County that night. And so there was a little bit of a conflict there. But no, it's great for the state. And it's I don't think y'all made a mistake. I didn't know it was in your district.
Nakima, okay, all right. We got some breaking news. It's going to be on the Oprah studio. But do we have any clues as to what the audience capacity is going to be?
It's still being built. So there wasn't, and like, it wasn't set up to host presidential debates. So all of this, the logistics are still being built out. And so we don't even have a cap number on capacity yet.
So we do want to make sure that people who are listening to the show realize that this is all done, although you're certainly going to be consulted on these things. This is MSNBC,
The
Washington Post, they and the DNC really are the ones who oversee and are in charge of all this stuff.
We're the partners in this, and we are not handling all of the logistics.
Yeah, I just don't want you to get all the, you know, the messages from people saying, you know,
but it's okay.
So let me ask you this. We've just learned this week that Amy Klobuchar has made the debate stage now. So is Tulsi Gabbard. And the reason I think particularly the Klobuchar inclusion is interesting is she is one of the more moderate candidates in that Democratic field. And so along with a Biden and a Buttigieg, they're going to have a more moderate message. When you've got Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders pushing such a progressive message, Do you worry about how that's received by Georgia voters? Again, it doesn't matter if the debate's here or in Philadelphia. That liberal message is having an impact out there, and it's troubling some Democrats.
It doesn't trouble me at all. I am thrilled that a lot of people are like, why do we have so many candidates? Can you, like, tell some of them they can't run? But I'm thrilled that we have so many candidates because this is the opportunity to grow our party and grow our base. There are a number of young people. They don't enter the party based on partisan politics. They enter it because of issues that they care about. And so this is an opportunity for us to talk about issues that are getting people engaged in the party process. So I am thrilled that we have a number of candidates on a wide spectrum. We're the big tent party, and we welcome people to come and talk about the issues that matter to them, to speak to the voters.
But, Patricia, would you want to be a Lucy McBath or any of the other Democratic candidates running and have reporters saying, well, the debate's coming. What do you think about Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All plan, Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan? Are you ready to say that you would support that plan? I get what the chairwoman is saying, but that liberal message is not playing well in Georgia, I would think.
I mean, it's playing well in some parts of Georgia, okay. I would say. Not in others, and that's what this debate process is for. There are a lot of places to run and hide for Democrats among this candidate field because there are so many diverse points of view. They could even highlight the number of diverse points of view as a selling point for the party. It's going to be a challenge for the party to incorporate those viewpoints and to make voters feel like they have a home in the party, even if they're not comfortable with all of those pieces of the platform.
Leo Smith is being whisked into the set. Go ahead, Jim, and then we'll get to Leo.
The one thing I would say is that we've had news that changes the course of this discussion since Atlanta was named as the debate center, and that is Kentucky and Virginia. And in both cases, the preservation of Obamacare was the primary issue. And so I think that we're seeing a slow turn away from Elizabeth Warren and Medicaid for All to that more centrist position.
Well, we'll watch how that unfolds. Leo Smith, let me invite you to the table. Thank you for being here. President Trump, you're a Republican president. I think was responsible for your being delayed here.
Well, and also it's just good free market principles that allow me to hop on a bird ride, go down the sidewalk, and make it.
That's what Tom Faust just sent me
an
email. Where did you park your car, Leo? How far from our studios?
Somewhat close to North Side Drive.
Did you really ditch your car?
I ditched a car. 14th Street is also
shut down.
And so I said, this isn't going to happen. I can run and do, you know, chance a meniscus or something, or I can hop on a bird.
Well,
and it was great.
Well, we admire your youthful spirit, Leo.
All to save America and make it great again.
Well, I'm glad you... let me turn to the fact that the president is in town and get everybody into the mix on this, but let's start with the fact that you had a news conference first thing this morning, 8:30 this morning, to greet the president with your own message about his visit and about his presidency. What did you say at your news conference?
So, President Trump coming to Atlanta today to launch his Black Voter Initiative,
yeah,
after all the things that he has done against communities of color in this country, I, for one, Atlanta is the city that's too busy to hate. We are the cradle of the civil rights movement. And everything that he's shown us is that is the opposite of what he stands for. And so to launch this in Atlanta is, I don't understand it. Black voters in Georgia voted Democratic 94% in 2018, and I'm looking to expand that. So he is launching this initiative here today. I don't know that he's going to pick up any more voters than he already had, but I wish him well in this failed attempt.
Leo, we should point out that you disavowed your support of the president some time ago, some months ago, and got
especially
a lot of...
Especially his rhetoric, right.
Particularly his rhetoric. So respond to what Nkema says about Trump launching this outreach to Black voters here.
Well, look, anytime citizens have an opportunity to engage with the president of the United States is a good thing. I mean, we should not hate the man, but we should want a plan. And that's where we have an opportunity here. Both Nkema with her caucus have a chance to present a plan to the Black community that's uplifting and empowering. Donald Trump says that he's had one. And what we need to understand understand Americans are at a place where they don't see Donald Trump as a cancer as much as they see him as the chemotherapy. And Black Americans, with the issues that we've faced for all these years, are seeing him, and some of them are seeing him that way as well. And that's really important. He's finished the work on prison reform, you know, that we started here in Georgia and Texas. He has record low unemployment of Black Americans. He has an approval rating from Black Americans that's up 15%. He's increased federal funding for HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities. He's created opportunity zone investment strategies that are helping put more money into places.
All right,
that
so you've got a list, and you think those are issues that he can run on. I'm going to let you respond
like
to that.
And then we should just ignore everything else that he has said.
No more than we ignore Lyndon B. Johnson having some racist attitudes, and Martin Luther King said, "We want your plan."
But I don't condone racist attitudes either.
Absolutely, and I don't either, and that's why I've disavowed racist attitudes. But I want Black Americans to have the focus of an agenda that really uplifts and empowers Black America, and we need to demand that from any politician.
Patricia, what's your take on this Black outreach here?
Well, you talked about chemotherapy, which can be a cure. It also has a lot of side effects that are very painful. And I would say that this president in the Black community has had a lot of painful side effects. He has passed very important reforms to criminal justice reform, a big piece of legislation that he passed with the help of Cory Booker. And I think if he was doing more of that and messaging more of that, the Black community would embrace him more. But when he comes to Atlanta and John Lewis's district that he called crime infested, and that John Lewis was all talk and no action, I think that reopens wounds in the Black community that they would like to heal. And so I think his agenda has been very strong, and the results have been very strong. If people could get past the side effects, I think they'd be a lot more inclined to go for the cure. But he's got a real problem with the Black community, as demonstrated by his election results so far. And I don't know that this, when he comes to Atlanta, I think we'll see a lot of the same faces that we see when he has his Black events, and it tends to be about the same 8 or 10 people. I do go to Trump rallies, and I do find minority members there, but they are in the drastic minority, and that's because of the words that he uses on Twitter specifically, but then also just generally. And I think if he could just be one or the other, people would know what to make of him.
Jim, I noticed that John Lewis put up a tweet this morning. He had a little video loop playing, wearing a T-shirt that was too busy to hate. A very pointed message to the president.
Right, what strikes me about the president's visit is that this is the first one that I can remember. You know, and we've been through these things since Carter, with motorcades coming in and coming out. I mean, Atlanta's a good ATM for campaign cash. Mm-hmm. But this is the first time that I can remember where it has really sparked a turnout in demonstrations. At Centennial Park for the Trump pro Black rally, and in Buckhead for his $3.5 million fundraiser.
Yeah, like you, we have people at all of those places. It'll be interesting. We have not gotten any reports on how the crowd is gathering at Centennial Park.
We don't have that, but Patricia's right. I mean, Herman Cain is among the people at the World Congress Center for Trump. I'm sure Elvita King. Look, Atlanta used to have, formerly, I mean, in years gone by, we're talking about 50 years ago, Atlanta had a thriving Black Republican power base. I mean, the Scots were an essential part of that.
As did the nation.
Nikki, it does strike me that the president, in fact, could very well be setting himself to come away looking rather foolish, trying to have an event to attract Black voters to his side on this. I mean, I think you make a lot of points, as does Patricia. I mean, all three of you are making points about the various aspects of Trump's presidency, but do you really imagine we're going to get much of a turnout of African Americans there today?
I'm sure there will be some people there, I don't think it's going to. I don't think it's going to equate into more Black people showing up to vote for Donald Trump by him launching this initiative.
It's important to note that this isn't like all Trump events. This is an invitation-only event.
Yes,
these people are screened. Right.
Yes.
And so you're not going to see, you're probably not going to see a whole lot of disruption there.
So these are people that were already supporting Donald Trump before they showed up today.
Yeah.
And that's the idea. This is a launch. This is not necessarily a rally. This isn't a let me introduce Trump to a new audience. This is a launch of an initiative that he has. And because of that, yeah, there are politicals that are already Republican coming from all over the country for this event.
Yeah.
I have people from North Carolina, Michigan, Florida. Some of them are even bussed in.
You know, but this is a way for Trump to introduce himself. After 3 years, that's kind of hard.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a whole lot of first impressions have gone on before this rally.
So it's never too late to start to do a good thing.
So, all right.
It's never too late to start to do a good thing, but he's the president of the United States. And the fact that he's only decided to do this through his reelection campaign as an initiative to elect Donald Trump and not to bring the country together as president is very troubling.
All right. Okay, we're going to watch how all of this unfolds. And by the way, if you're watching us on TV on Sunday, clearly we are recording this show for air on Sunday morning, even as we're on the radio today, Friday, live. Patricia, let's turn to another interesting side note to this visit. Doug Collins was on Air Force One, flying in here with the president. He, of course, has put his name in the hat to be the replacement for Johnny Isaacson, hoping that Governor Kemp will appoint him to fill the seat until the special election next November. Do we think that the president is, and we had Don Jr. here not long ago, holding
raising
a
money
fundraiser
for Doug Collins
and saying this guy would be great advocate for us in the Senate. Is the president, do you think, nudging Kemp in the Doug Collins direction?
I don't think the president does nudge, you know. I think he's going to be like, just appoint the guy, you know. He does have a really strong relationship with Collins. And Collins would be a really strong appointment to that job. I mean, I think he is clearly qualified. I think he has a more interesting profile than most Democrats probably give him credit for in terms of being a pastor and a military chaplain. Mm-hmm. And he's a lawyer. He certainly knows his way around the legislative process. The trick for Republicans, though, and we're talking about expanding the profiles and putting people in front of voters who don't look exactly like all the other Republicans, probably the biggest strike against Doug Collins right now is that he is not a woman or a minority or some way to grow the profile of the Republican Party for voters. But I think he certainly has to be a leading candidate for Brian Kemp because he's probably the most qualified in there right now.
Just as important as Doug Collins being on the same plane with with President Trump were the fact that the two Purdue cousins were also on Air Force One.
Yeah.
And you'll have to remember it was Sonny Perdue, the now Secretary of Agriculture, who was the fellow who brought Brian Kemp to Donald Trump's attention last year and during the primary runoff.
And I think I'm right that we believe that both of them are pretty enthusiastic about Doug Collins for that seat, are we not? Don't we have that sense?
I haven't seen any overt signs, okay. but yeah, the talk is that they are.
All right.
And Patricia, I would add that, you know, years ago at President Trump's first inauguration, there was it wasn't a fundraiser, it was a minority engagement event for conservatives held in D.C. Doug Collins was the only congressman from our delegation that gave underwriting to that, that sent people to that, that sent a word of encouragement about minority voter engagement. He has a commitment. You know, we haven't built a strong enough field to have the diversity of people that we want to choose from, and that's candidly true. But he is a guy who really understands it.
All right. Nakima, as long as we're talking about the Senate race, you've got a really robust Democratic Senate race underway for for the David Perdue seat. Well, we're calling race number one, as opposed to that open Johnny Isaacson seat, race number two. How are you watching the race unfold? It's interesting. John Ossoff this evening is having a little event at Manuel's Tavern, his counter to the Trump presence here today. Teresa Tomlinson released a very funny
the popcorn
video, sitting watching the president getting booed at the World Series with David Perdue at his side. How do you see that race shaping up?
I mean, I see, we're letting our candidates run in the primary field, and we're elevating them all. And I know whoever comes out of our primary field are going to be better than David Perdue, because he has shown us that he is willing to tie himself directly to Donald Trump. And I am ready to stand behind our Democratic nominee so that we can make sure that we send Perdue packing.
Are you at all worried about the fact that, with the except with Ossoff, his start has raised some pretty fairly significant monies, but Tomlinson has had more trouble. Amico's, you know, kind of trying to make strides. Ted Terry hasn't gotten very far at all. I mean, obviously, when you get a candidate for the general, money will start coming in bigger quantities, we imagine. But does it worry you that while a David Perdue can raise so much money out there, and he'll get more after this event today, the fundraiser for him, that your candidates have so far not shown a lot of muscle in fundraising?
So after May in the primary, we're going to come together and we're going to make sure that our candidate has the resources, the boots on the ground, and the messaging getting out there to Georgia voters so that we can elect a Democrat to the U.S. Senate.
Patricia, what do you sense as you look at that race, in terms of fundraising particularly?
Well, the fundraising numbers could be a lot better. They just could. It's very hard with two Senate races on the horizon, with a number of competitive Senate seats and no incumbent in the state to pull from in any kind of existing fundraising base. It's going to be really, really tough. And that's why, if you're Democrats, you'd rather see somebody with a proven fundraising advantage to be able to hold their own after the primary, because they're going to have to be fundraising against a number of other Democrats nationally and locally. But I do think, to Chairwoman Williams' point, the resources are going to be there for this nominee. They could get outspent, but they're not going to get outplanned and outmaneuvered on the ground.
And I'm going to make sure of that.
Yeah, the Democrats nationally are going to invest money in Georgia. They just will. And so both of the Senate candidates are going to benefit from that. There's going to be, I think, a team effort that's going to support whoever it is coming up here. But none of those candidates has really broken out in a big way that I kind of would have expected by now.
Yeah. You're starting to see something that Stacey Abrams showed us in the 2018 race, and that is the necessity of going outside of the state in order to raise Democratic money. Because of what you're talking about, because the ground is going to be so heavily picked over by the presidential and senatorial candidates that it's just going to be very, very hard for individuals not to tap those big pots of money that are in California, New York, and Chicago and elsewhere, just selling Georgia as the next battleground state.
Which is strategically wise important. That people who are in retirement as Republicans, like Jeff Sessions, or maybe that can go in there and make that well shrink even more and make the Democrats have to work harder in other states. I think we're going to see more people than Jeff Sessions talking about getting back into races.
You think Jeff Sessions is going to make the Democrats work harder to hold on to that Doug Jones seat?
Absolutely.
Really? Okay, that's interesting. Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way. We've got an awful lot more to discuss. But first... Let's do this. We'll come back with more on Political Rewind.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Thirty years after the Berlin Wall came down, some dividing lines persist in Germany. An influx of refugees from the Middle East has bolstered anti-immigrant feelings.
I was in a shop, coffee shop. One guy just told me, go back to your country and fight.
We check in with a Syrian refugee living in Germany this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
4 till 7 today on GPB and gpbnews.org.
We're back on Political Rewind. Just to reset the table, we have Jim Galloway, of course, from the AJC here, the chairwoman of the Georgia Democratic Party and state senator from Atlanta, Nakima Williams, is with us. By the way, you know, we're all about being kind of casual on this show, and I've called you by your first name a few times.
I'm Nakima.
Are you okay
I'm
with
Nakima.
That? Thank you.
Yes.
I just want to make sure that's all right. Patricia Murphy, who we always call Patricia
that's
when
not.
She's here on the show, is with us. She, of course, is a syndicated columnist. I read her in Roll Call, but you can also see her in many newspapers across the country.
Yeah.
And Leo Smith, a Republican strategist, formerly the outreach coordinator for the Georgia Republican Party. Really quickly, Leo, Jim, Tom Faust during that break said in my ear, I don't know, it sounds like Leo may be getting back on the Trump train. What did you hear, Jim?
I think he's a little bit standoffish right now, but right back. I'm not sure that he can be brought back into that circle, but I'm not sure that he wants to cut his Republican ties.
Are you, Leo?
There's no way that I would cut the Republican ties. I mean, the Republican Party was started as an abolitionist party. It was started for people
Tops
like
change.
Me. And we can return to that. But what can the Democrat Party return to?
Wait,
I don't think we want to return to that.
So does that mean that we already can tell that you're going to vote for President Trump for re-election?
I'm not voting for a Democrat.
All right. Speaking of voting, Jim, Patricia, I want to get your takes on this first. It looks like Michael Bloomberg really is going to run for president. He's talking today about getting on the Alabama ballot. And, of course, that's because it's the earliest deadline for Friday. But Bloomberg very well might be running as a Democrat for president. Yeah. You mentioned it briefly earlier. What do you think about this?
I'm wondering if this is a break glass and emergency kind of candidacy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I can't see him penetrating in Iowa. Maybe he can do something in New Hampshire. I think probably where he probably has an advantage is on Super Tuesday, when you have not just a few southern states, not Georgia, but a few other southern states and California.
You've got to spend a lot of money getting your message out
exactly.
into those. Are there a dozen states on this Super
He's
Tuesday,
got a lot
something
to spend.
Like that?
And so that may be his entry. I would say, Stop and Frisk is going to be a problem with him for him with the African American community, and yet the Democrats will love what he's done for Lucy McBath and other gun violence activists.
Patricia?
Call me a skeptic on the Michael Bloomberg. I lived in New York when he was mayor. He was a great mayor.
Yeah.
I mean, plowed the snow,
yeah.
Trains ran on time.
Yeah.
The people who love to talk about this possibility of Michael Bloomberg running are Wall Street bankers and New York reporters. And that's really his constituency right now. No one can tell me who is the Michael Bloomberg voter that's not being served by this field right now, other than the people who want a guarantee the Democrats going to beat Donald Trump. And even then, I don't know how Michael Bloomberg beats Donald Trump in a way that Hillary Clinton could not. I just don't know. He may or may not even play in Iowa, I'm hearing. He may not even bother to go to Iowa. And I just have a hard time. I've been on TV set since 2006 speculating, will he or won't he? He really wants to. I believe his heart is in the issues. Democrats I talk to wish he would just put more money behind a single candidate and make his money count that way.
Yeah.
He's got a real deficit of charisma. If you've ever sat through one of his stump speeches, it's not exactly a barn burner. So I don't know how he comes in late. It's actually hard to spend a lot of money in the next 3 months if he doesn't already have his ads cut. I see room for his ideas. I don't see room for him.
While Patricia was talking, I did some very quick Google work.
Yes.
And I reminded myself that I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma with Michael Bloomberg and Sam Nunn in 2007 when they were pitching the thought about a presidential run by one or the other.
Yeah. Yes,
wow.
Or both.
Wow.
Or both.
Yeah.
Yes.
Patricia, of course,
that.
Used to work for Senator Nunn. Nakima, you said earlier in this show, big tent party, you welcome all comers who want to run for the Democratic nomination. But let me ask you this. If Bloomberg at this point is deciding he wants to jump in, and if we've seen any number of polls that show us Yes, we see that Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders seem to be bunched up near the top. But we see really more Democrats saying they're still completely up in the air about who they really are going to support in the long run. Does a potential Bloomberg candidacy send a signal that the Democrats haven't quite figured out who ought to be the nominee and the right person isn't there at this point?
Well, I mean, Democrats haven't figured out who's going to be the nominee. That's what this primary process
Absolutely.
Is about.
But so, that there's not a candidate who people are, you know, going to rally around, that none of them are really the right person to rally around.
I think right now we are talking about ideas. And Bloomberg spent a lot of money in Virginia to help with some of the races there, with some of the gun violence and gun reform issues. And so right now, this is about ideas. That's what the primary process is about, getting the best ideas out there so that we know who we want to rally behind as we go through the primary process. That's what this debate season is about. We're going to hear a lot of robust discussion on the stage here in Atlanta, and we have more debates to come. So I'm ready to continue to listen. I don't have a chosen candidate yet, and I keep listening to all of them. Like, I watch the debates, and every night my husband thinks that I'm crazy. I'm like, oh, I'm going to send him $10. I want him on the debate stage. And I have, like, five or six people that I keep sending my little $10 to when I hear something that they say because I want to keep the conversation going.
Okay, so you're one of those people who wants more and more people on the stage instead of narrowing the focus.
I want to hear more and more focus on issues that matter to me, okay. Which is why if you say something that resonates with me, I send you my little $10 so that I can help with your...
Thank you. Then I think it's an appropriate moment to say to you, what are the issues that matter to you? What are the issues you think matter to Georgia voters in this election cycle?
So I started a statewide listening tour when I first got elected as chair, and I've been across the state, as far north as when I got in the parking lot, that most of the tags were Tennessee, and down in Valdosta where there are a lot of Florida plates. And so one of the things that I hear about everywhere is around healthcare. Mm. And I don't know what the answer is. I know what our governor is pushing here in Georgia is not the answer. But I don't know. I know that we have an option for Medicaid expansion. That's what I hear across the state, no matter which part of the state I'm in. If I'm in Atlanta, if I'm down in LaGrange, in Valdosta, in Swainsboro, in Whitfield County, all across the state, I keep hearing about health care. That is the number one issue across the board.
And the question is, what kind of health care?
That is the question.
A refinement?
That's why we're having this conversation, because the candidates don't even have the same proposals around health care. So we're having this discussion. We just happen to be having the discussion in front of millions and millions of Americans to hear us think out loud. So,
you know, Chairwoman, the prototype has already been done. Donald Trump had to compete with several Republican candidates. And what he did was something that, interestingly, actually unified Republicans around an idea, although his rhetoric is all most people consider somewhat divisive. But Donald Trump really right now is offering the only unifying idea, America First. And Democrats really haven't presented anything that really unifies people and sort of gives people something to rally around.
Leah, you're saying Donald Trump is unifying people?
Well, no. That concept was something that people that worked as a concept. Because not everybody is unified on the idea of what we need to do with health care. So, the challenge for Democrats is coming up with something, some candidate coming up with something that grabs everybody.
Patricia, I know you want to jump in. I'm going to just quickly say America First is a slogan. I'm not sure what you think about it as an idea. I mean, I'm not sure what it means, but Patricia, go ahead.
Well, I think that Donald Trump has a slogan. I think Democrats, in a lot of ways, it doesn't matter what their slogan is, as long as it meets the lowest bar possible for some voters. That is an alternative to Donald Trump. And I think the danger they get into for Democrats is that a lot of the ideas that Democratic candidates are putting forth are seen as such a big change, such an unknown, such a radical change from where we ever thought we would be in some policy areas, including health care, including Medicare for All. That's where Democrats get into danger. If Democrats can present a safe harbor away from Donald Trump, I think Democrats win the election. The election is not really going to be about Democrats' ideas. It's going to be, can you give us somebody else to vote for the next four years
This is a lane that Michael Bloomberg can drive in, yes. which is right. competence.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I think that's the low bar that you're talking about.
Yes. Did he look at Beshear in Kentucky, did Bloomberg look at Beshear and go, okay, that's not a popular Republican governor. I can be the guy who can come in and do that.
Matt Bevin,
right? Mm-hmm. Matt Bevin wasn't popular. So did Michael Bloomberg say, if I run as a centrist person, will I find favor in the same way that happened in Kentucky?
I think Michael Bloomberg would like to see a stronger version of Joe Biden right yeah. now. And Joe Biden just isn't delivering on the debate stage the way a lot of moderates are hoping that he will. He's just not. It's also never really been his venue to be giving these big barn burner speeches and to really be, you know, knocking out punches on the debate stage. That's never really been his strength. But I think moderates want to see somebody they know is going to win. I don't know if they're going to get that guarantee, and I think that's where Michael Bloomberg comes
in. So before we go to our final break, Nkema, you talked about health care being the big issue, and I want to relate that to the column that Galloway has in the Sunday paper, but which is online right now. Jim, to make it, just to say it in its simplest terms, you compare the Kemp Medicaid waiver plan, the waivers that he's looking for, which will only be a partial expansion of Medicaid, to some 50,000
right.
of the 400,000+, and you compare that to what happened in the Kentucky governor's race, where Beshears beat Matt Bevin, perhaps in part because it was Bevin who tried to undo Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, basically, Brian Kemp is eschewing this the massive expansion of Medicaid to cover some 408,000, maybe 500,000 of uninsured Georgians. What he is doing is he's putting more emphasis on helping people who already have health insurance to keep their health insurance. And then he's opening a slight window, a 50,000-person window of Medicaid expansion. More money is being put into the effort to help people keep the insurance they already have.
So Nkema, what one of the points, of course, is that, your candidates in 2020, I mean, it's not until 2022 that Brian Kemp will face the voters over how he handled health care here. But in 2020, Republicans will, in fact, have to deal with how the state is approaching Medicaid expansion. And I think what Galloway is suggesting is that if Georgia is anything like Kentucky, voters might not be particularly happy with Republicans over the issue of a limited
expansion.
We're
spending more money to cover fewer people. Medicaid expansion would go ahead cover 400,000 Georgians who lack access to health care, and we're spending more money when we are already having budget cuts across the state. But so you would think that we would be a little more mindful of how we're spending our funds and how we are making sure that we cover people all across the state. This is an issue that affects people in rural Georgia and metro Atlanta. No matter where you go, there are people that will be covered in this 400,000 Georgians.
Leo, you get the last word before we take our break.
Well, I think it's a good thing that we have the job economy that we have, because the more people have jobs, the more they can have insurance.
Do you think a job should be a prerequisite for having insurance, as Governor Kemp now suggests with the Medicaid expansion?
I think that is nuanced. I mean, you know, we cannot solve all needs with every budget. And I think that, you know, it would be nice if all children, especially, and we do that in Georgia, have health care, and I think we do a good job of that.
Okay, let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way. We'll be back with more on Political Rewind.
My name is Lauren Lynn, and I'm the Associate Director of Marketing for Georgia Farm Bureau. Georgia Farm Bureau is the voice of Georgia farmers, and we work earnestly to support the state's leading industry, agriculture. We underwrite with GPB. What I like about the programming is that it reaches a diverse audience, and it enables individuals or organizations the opportunity to share their messaging across the state.
To find out more about becoming a corporate sponsor, email sponsorship@gpb.org.
Lactose or sucrose, cow's milk or soy? These are the questions parents are asking about their baby formula. I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, a look at the ingredients in infant formula and what science says about them, plus why European formula brands have become so popular with parents. All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Join us for Science Friday this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
I've already mentioned it once. If you're listening on the radio, you're hearing us live right now. If you're watching us on Sunday morning, we're recording the show on Friday afternoon. And a very, very quick note that if it is Friday and you're listening on the radio, I'm going to be talking to Preet Bharara, the former Southern District of New York U.S. attorney fired by President Trump back in 2017 when he wasn't willing to even take phone calls from the president, worried about how the president might be trying to manipulate him in a general way. We're going to be at the Atlanta Jewish Book Festival tomorrow night at 8 p.m. I just checked with them. They've still got a few tickets left. If you feel like coming up there, you can go to the Atlanta Jewish Book Festival website and get more information. It really should be an interesting conversation. Nakima Williams, the Democratic Party of Georgia has now filed a lawsuit on absentee ballots. Mm-hmm. Your concerns being that absentee ballots are being unfairly and inequitably thrown out. Tell us about the suit.
So there's no standards right now of how people are notified when their absentee ballots are rejected. And if you're going to reject someone's absentee ballot, there should be some standards across the board on how people are notified so that they know that they can follow up and they can cure the problem, or that they can vote regularly. But right now, we have 159 counties and 159 ways to do things. And if there is one person that is disenfranchised by a lack of standards, enforceable standards, then we need to do something about it. And the Democratic Party of Georgia, under my watch, will be the party for democracy.
And this lawsuit would ask that all election officials notify a voter within the same day that their signatures are challenged.
Yes. If your ballot is rejected, mm-hmm. you should receive a notification that day.
So, Jim, we do want to point out, I think, that the last session, that particularly Democrats in the Stacey Abrams organization during the last election cycle pointed out any number of concerns about voter integrity. And the legislature did act on some of them.
Right,
had some reform.
Right. Last year, there were something like, I think, 8,000 absentee ballots rejected statewide. A lot of them, in fact, a good number of them, came from Gwinnett, which is a very contentious county right now. So it's a lot, and a lot of it was based on this signature that you gave us 5 years ago doesn't look like the signature that you're penning down today, and that comes down to a single individual's judgment, which is
and it
tricky.
Has a disproportionate impact on Black voters. 49% of the absentee ballots that were cast in Gwinnett County last year were Black or Hispanic voters.
Well, I guess one of the reasons I mentioned the legislation that did pass last year is, in addition to filing a federal lawsuit, whether you would anticipate that we'll see legislation introduced in this upcoming session to remedy the problem you're talking about, too.
I welcome it. I will pre-file it. And I welcome my Republican colleagues to sign on with me and to make sure that everybody's vote is protected. It's not just about Democrats.
I would not be surprised to see Republicans try to tighten the requirements for absentee ballots. If you'll recall during the voter ID days of 2007 and beyond, it was all about in-person voting. The one area they left out was absentee voting, because that's what Republicans relied on in elections. Well, with the Abrams campaign, that changed. There was a heavy Democratic emphasis on absentee ballots.
The legislator needs to address all these issues, and it's good to hear that, pre-filing will occur, because it needs to be robustly debated. And we have a Secretary of State and Brad Raffensperger that I think wants to make sure that Georgia feels gung-ho about voter access, about voter integrity and voter security. So I think this is an opportunity for Georgia to lead again, and I think you've got a Secretary of State that will support that. And full disclosure, my company, Engage Futures and EFG Strategies, is advising Brad Raffensperger on some voting issues.
Got some branding in there.
Well, maybe you can put in a good word to make sure that we tighten up our standards for democracy.
Hey, Patricia, before we leave, I want to go to one of the columns that you wrote, one of your syndicated columns recently, because we are heading into a week where we're going to see the first public hearings on impeachment on Wednesday and Friday coming up. You wrote a column, the headline of which is, "Impeachment is already a gold mine. Shut down fundraising until it's over." It really resonated with me. And because we talked about this on the show the other day, doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Everybody's fundraising on impeachment. You think it's wrong.
People aren't just fundraising during impeachment. I mean, they are fundraising on impeachment. And the people who are most successful at fundraising on impeachment are the highest profile members on both all of these committees. And so when you go through all the public disclosures, what I noticed, because I like to casually go through FEC disclosure reports, all of those names would be familiar to anybody who watches cable news, because it was Jim Jordan, Adam Schiff, a number of the members of the House Judiciary Committee, House Intelligence Committee, Lindsey Graham, and the most especially of all is President Trump raised tens of millions of dollars during the impeachments or the pre-impeachment proceedings. And my thought is that the correlation there is that there really is no incentive right now for members of Congress who I would hope, and I think most people would hope, would be approaching impeachment judiciously and impartially. There's a huge incentive to get on TV, get attention, and raise some money off of the impeachment trial. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, you name, in addition to the ones you said, Devin Nunes, we're not surprised by that, Raja Krishnamoorthy of Illinois, Eric Swalwell, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Both sides.
Yeah, and it I think it's particularly troubling when you come to the senators who are going to be acting as literal jurors in an impeachment trial. The president, including with Senator Perdue, has launched a number of these joint fundraising committees where he's going to be raising money for senators who are up in 2020. And to me, that creates just a very uncomfortable conflict of interest. People are going to have to be voting on the president's fate, and he has just raised, Senator Perdue, and we'll do this for others, $3.5 million in one day. It just creates a situation that's not necessary. And when you look to a number of legislatures around the state, 29 legislatures around the country, rather, forbid fundraising during the legislative process while the legislature's in session, to just take away that incentive for action based on money.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see it. It's very naive and never going to happen, but that's my that's what that column was
for. What do you think? I mean, look, let's face it, one of the responsibilities you have is to make sure the Georgia Democrats have enough money to fuel their campaigns. But what do you think about what Patricia's saying about up there in Washington in terms of fundraising around impeachment?
I want to read the column, because I think that this impeachment process is so much bigger than just a political party, because this is the foundation of our democracy. The offenses that the president is being accused of, they're serious. And we need to have we need to be able to look at this impartially, regardless of your partisan politics. And I know that that's not going to happen, and that's naive of me to think that it could be done without looking at it through a partisan lens. But this is so much bigger. This is the foundation of our democracy is at stake here.
Jim, we're heading into what will be the most deeply partisan proceedings that
we've
seen.
And it is not a criminal trial. It is a political trial.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think Patricia's right. I mean, can you truly look at David Perdue and say, well, the president just raised you $3.5 million. Can you? How are you going to vote?
How can you be a juror?
How are you going to vote?
Where are you on? Where are you on?
In a large way, you know, this is sort of it's a huge example of the problem that we've had for a long time with politicians using things that, you know, engender fear, that to raise money off of it. And Lucy Macbeth, I've got a letter from her asking to help her fund impeachment. I mean, so it's happening all over the place. It's an issue, but that's an issue of, you know, what Americans will tolerate.
All right.
We need to discuss it.
I got to call a halt. We're out of time for this conversation. Jim Galloway, you know, it's great having you here. I'll see you again on Monday at 2 o'clock another Political Rewind. Patricia Murphy, thank you
for
being with us. I look forward to seeing what is your next column?
My next column is about Rudy Giuliani, and with a friend like Rudy Giuliani, who needs the U.S. Senate?
All right. And Chairwoman Nkema Williams, thank you so much. Your schedule is so busy, but we're so happy you were able
thank
to find
you.
Time to be
Glad
with
to
us
be
today. And have fun at the debate next Wednesday night. Leo Smith, time to get back on your scooter. You win the award for getting here with the most ingenuity. We appreciate it. And thank you all for being here for Political Rewind. See you Monday at 2:00.